Up tonight at 7, DJ Ben Franklin Stein, your volunteer host for On the River. Increasing clouds tonight, slight chance for showers, lows 56 to 63.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
On the attack, last night Russia pounded Ukraine with missiles and more than 700 drones. A Ukrainian MP tells us those attacks are also an act of disrespect directed at Donald Trump and that he should respond by giving her country the weapons and support it desperately needs.
And his signature trick was called The Impossible, which took on new resonance when he taught himself to skate again after a shooting left him blind. Now, San Francisco has honored the late skateboarder Zion Williams Gaines by giving his name to a skate park he loved.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on People Powered KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in this evening. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a few moments, we'll hear the set list from Malachi Coon, some live music you can check out in the area this weekend. But right now, we are going to listen to a song from Margot Price. She is performing at this year's Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th. She will be joined by Courtney Barnett, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find your tickets and more information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Again, Saturday, September 6th, we'll be in the Grand Rapids Area Library Amphitheater right next door to KAXE. The song from Margot Price features Jonathan Wilson, and it's called Malibu.
Crowded everywhere, but I still feel lonely. Everybody talks and fall up alone. Where can I run that I haven't already? Hands start shaking and my heart ain't steady. They say love and grief are a package deal. The more you have, the more you feel. But I tried to forget it. What happened next? Couldn't have guessed it. Chase that dream all the way to Malibu. It's an unfinished business to attend to. But I blame myself, I don't blame you for leaving me stranded in Malibu. Darkness left me standing barefoot and collars. Take it all back, take it all back to zero. Used to be a loser, but now I'm a hero. Climb the stairs till I got to the bottom. Grandpa always said, smoke, I'll make you got it. Spent half my days drunk on pills of pot. But I can't complain, cause I got a lot. Chase that dream all the way to Malibu. With some unfinished business to attend to. But I blame myself, I don't blame you for leaving me stranded in Malibu.
This is the set list on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Thursday, July 10th through Saturday, July 12th in Duluth, Grand Rapids, Boston, Crosby, and Coleraine. Starting things off, the first of three Thursday shows is the Cactus Blossoms and Boxcar from 5 to 8 p.m. in Duluth, part of the Downtown Days celebration. The retro country and rock and roll group, led by brothers Jack Torrey and Paige Burkham, are fan favorites, with a live band that includes in-demand players Jake and Jeremy Hansen. Opening for them are Boxcar, a Duluth, alt, and classic country band. That's 5 p.m. in downtown Duluth. In Grand Rapids, Diddy Wish is performing with her new band at Rapids Brewing at 6 p.m. Since the release of her debut EP, Songs About Home, the singer-songwriter has added keys and drums to her solo sound. Thursday at 6 in Grand Rapids. Then at 7 o'clock, Kaylee are performing in Boston. The Bemidji-based trio fuse folk, Celtic, bluegrass, and old time. The show is at the East Polk Heritage Center, Thursday night at 7. On to Friday, Americana singer-songwriter Scott Jasmine is performing in Crosby at 7. It'll be at the Cana Wine Bar. And then on Saturday, Mount Itasca in Coleraine is hosting their Music on the Mountain Festival with eclectic blues duo Brothers Burn Mountain and folk rock group Morning Bird. Gates open at 5 p.m. and music begins at 6. That is Music on the Mountain, this Saturday, 5 o'clock at Mount Itasca. Do you have information on live music you'd like us to know about? Email comments at kaxc.org. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Night.
No room at the inns. Choked by wildfire smoke, a Manitoba Cree community is working to get its most vulnerable people out to safety. But their deputy chief tells us that will not happen until his people have somewhere safe to go.
Scarlet letters. Toronto is considering new color-coded signage to alert prospective renters to bad landlords. A tenant advocate explains why she thinks that public shaming could help.
Moment of truth. After a barrage of drone attacks from Russia, a Ukrainian MP in Kyiv calls a timely renewal of support from the U.S. a matter of pure survival.
Shelf portrait. How the threat of American tariffs on Asian imports is already shrinking profits for the independent grocers who serve immigrant communities in the U.S.
Flipping the script. When he lost his sight, a young man in San Francisco immediately set out to become the best blind skateboarder around. And 2 years after his death, the city is honoring his legacy.
And not so great strides. Bodyguards protecting the Prime Minister of Sweden are potentially endangering the Prime Minister of Sweden by posting their runs to a fitness app, repeatedly revealing exactly where he is. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that knows if you forget where the PM is, his guards will jog your memory. A Manitoba Cree Nation says it's in the midst of an emergency. Wildfires are burning nearby, and Nisichewayasik is trying to get hundreds of elders and people with chronic health issues out of harm's way. The challenge is that there doesn't seem to be anywhere for them to go. Earlier this week, Indigenous Services Canada told leaders in the community that there were no hotel rooms free anywhere in the province. The Red Cross also said there was no place for evacuees to go in Alberta, BC, or even Ontario. Marcel Moody is the community's deputy chief. We reached him in Nelson House on Nisichewayasik Cree Nation.
Deputy chief, as we speak right now, how many people are you most worried about trying to get them out of the community as these fires get closer?
Yeah, we're trying to get about 300 people out of our community. People, you know, with respiratory issues, health issues, you know, people from our personal care home. People with heart conditions, COPD, and all those respiratory issues that people have. Those are the people we're trying to get out. But, you know, the smoke, you know, during the nights, I mean, it's pretty heavy in our community. People have a hard time breathing. So we're trying to get, you know, the people with the health issues, you know, out of our community.
Yeah, and you're describing some of the conditions there. I can only imagine what it's like. What has it been like the last few days when you step outside, not just in the middle of the night as people are trying to sleep?
Well, I mean, on Sunday, I mean, the smoke was so heavy, you could hardly see, you know, your neighbor's house. Mm. It was so dense. And this has been ongoing for the last week. And hopefully it doesn't get worse, but, you know, we're not going to take a chance or I'm evacuating those people, you know, with health conditions, you know, out of our community.
Yeah, what are the logistics involved? at this stage, given what's happening around you, to try to get everyone to safety?
Well, we have buses in our community that are ready to go. I think we've taken out about 127 yesterday. Hopefully, we don't have to evacuate the rest of the community, but I guess at some point in time, if we have to, we will.
And there's a single road out. Is that right?
Single road access, yeah.
The state of emergency you declared on Sunday afternoon because of that heavy smoke you were describing. You've been reaching out to organizations, including the Red Cross. What kind of response have you been getting?
For the most part, I think everybody's supportive. I mean, we have some, sometimes we don't agree, you know, with what Red Cross has to say. But you know what? We're determined, you know, we know what's best for our people. So at this point in time, you know, we're taking action, you know, to move our people out. I mean, but the problem we have is, I mean, we don't have, you know, accommodations readily available. We have to, you know, we're supposed to take people to Saskatoon. That changed. Now we're moving our people to Portage, La Prairie, mm-hmm. in different hotels, constantly changing locations. We're constantly changing the logistics, you know, of our plan. There's just no accommodations in Manitoba anymore, and more people are being evacuated. So probably causing a logistical nightmare for Red Cross and the people involved.
There have been fires and evacuations certainly in the past, Deputy Chief, as you well know. So how is it that there are no accommodations this time? What's going on?
Well, there's been so many communities that have been evacuated. Mm-hmm. There's Leaf Rapids, Lynn Lake, Southern Lake, Pagetwagon, Cross Lake. There's been so many evacuees, you know, heading, you know, to Southern Manitoba, you know, looking for accommodations. I mean, it's discouraging, not knowing, you know, where people are going to go. Because typically, what we like to do is, you know, we want our people together. We don't want people, you know, isolated in different hotels or place in different pockets, and because it creates a lot of work, you know, for ourselves, you know, that are trying to coordinate, you know, these evacuations and keeping track of our people. I mean, it's a logistical nightmare.
Have you heard anything from provincial officials in Manitoba or even the federal government at this point? Because if there are no hotels or you know, the regular places that people stay are booked, they can, they'll build, you know, they'll set up temporary sites in disaster zones all the time.
Yeah, we've been in communications with the province. We have a meeting regularly with the province, Red Cross, and the province. We have constant communication. But I mean, the simple fact is that there's no accommodations anywhere or very limited accommodations. I can't even imagine, you know, what we're going to do if we have to move the rest of our people out of NCN. I don't know where they're gonna go. Maybe have, you know, 100 here, 100 there, and it's just gonna be crazy.
How many people, besides the ones we were initially speaking about, the most vulnerable, those priority one, two and three, you were saying, how many overall might have to leave?
We have about 3,000 people altogether in the community.
Yeah.
Over 3,000, but we have lots of people.
I can hear the worry in your voice, Deputy Chief. What about people there, what are they saying to you?
Well, they want, obviously, I mean, they look up to us in terms, you know, you know, what the plan is. People are asking whether the whole community is going to be evacuated. So people are concerned. I mean, they see the smoke. People are starting to get affected by the smoke, and people are worried. I mean, there's anxiety. I mean, people, you know, have anxieties, you know. You know, for the travel and for leaving the community, not knowing where they're going, how are they going to get there, and so it's just it's traumatic for our people.
How are you doing?
I'm not doing too bad. I mean, they know things are changing every moment, every hour, every day. We have plans in place, but I mean, it seems so. You know, things, you know, can change very quickly, and it confuses, you know, people. But, you know, hopefully we have rain in the next few days. Hopefully, you know, that'll help with the fires. We're in a difficult situation.
Deputy Chief, I appreciate this. You can speak to us in the middle of the difficulties you're all going through. I hope you get answers and some concrete plans soon for folks there. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Marcel Moody is the Deputy Chief of Nisichewayasik Cree Nation. We reached him in Nelson House. Overnight, Russia launched missiles and more than 700 drones at Ukraine. That aerial attack set a single-night record in this war. The country's northwest got the worst of the strikes, which came after U.S. President Donald Trump profanely expressed his displeasure with President Putin, saying, quote, "He's very nice to us all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless," unquote. Kira Rudik is a member of Ukrainian parliament and the leader of the political party Khalos. We reached her in Kyiv.
Kira Rudik, it has been a relentless series of attacks over the past couple of weeks, multiple nights of these drone attacks. How are things in Kyiv tonight?
Neil, the things are tough because if you can imagine, there is one thing that is much worse than sitting in the bomb shelter with your family. It is sitting in the bomb shelter with your family knowing that perhaps the air defense systems may not have enough of the supplies to take down everything that is going our way. This is why it is so critical for us to get as quickly as possible the renewed weapons and support from the United States, because it's a matter of pure survival for us.
Ukraine's Air Force has said nearly 300 of these drones and 7 missiles were shot down, and says another 415 drones were lost from radars or jamming. If Russia is indeed expanding its drone production capacity and ramping up attacks, and you spoke about your worries there as we started our conversation, what capacity does your country have right now as it stands to fend off this kind of barrage of attacks?
We know that obviously what we have is not enough. And when we are talking, there are different type of missiles and drones that are coming our way. And to take it down, we need different kind of weapons and missiles and technologies. And so one of the most critical ones is the Patriot missile system that is provided by the United States and can only be purchased from them. And it is used to be taking down the ballistic missiles that Russia is constantly sending our way. And this is why for us it is so critical to get this particular type of equipment. And unfortunately, we cannot get it anywhere else but from the United States.
So are you heartened or reassured then by what Donald Trump said on Monday, reversing course, saying he would be sending weapons to Ukraine? I mean, do you believe what you're hearing? Are you calmed by that?
I'm cautiously optimistic, I would say, but I would be calmer and comfortable when the weapons will arrive, because again, you cannot fight Russia with words, right? We have heard so many things from President Trump over the course of the last 6 months. So we are glad to hear that at least there are some promises there, but we also need to have these promises executed. On the other hand, I think if President Trump backs from what he said right now, after the Putin gave him such a clear disrespect and slap in the face when he launched the most massive attack on Ukraine right after he had a call with President Trump, if President Trump will show the world that he can tolerate this, that would be like as such a strong sign of weakness that Iran, Russia, North Korea, and China will look at as something that would put pressure them to go ahead with their attempts to destroy the democracy.
But does, for Ukraine, a frosty relationship between Putin and Trump, does that actually hurt your country? You're caught in that back and forth.
We are. You know, what I'm thinking is that President Trump, when he came in office, he allowed himself some time and gave Putin an opportunity to come down. And he was saying that he thinks that Putin wants peace. We said that there was not a single clear fact that would support the statement. And right now, President Trump sees that. He was not able to get anything, like literally anything from Putin that he was asking for, nor like a meeting or with President Zelensky or an agreement to ceasefire or anything. And this is why right now, when he says that he's being very successful on the international arena, basically Ukraine is the only place where he cannot say that anything is a victory for him.
I'll ask you something I've asked before throughout these now years of this conflict after Russia's invasion. Does peace seem further away on a day like today or closer than it's been before?
It's very hard to say. I don't see peace in the foreseeable future. This is the truth. So it's hard to say, like, how far is it? Because if we look wider than Ukraine, do you think that ceasefire or even a peace would stop Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran from manufacturing weapons, from exchanging the technologies, from like building up for the next war? I don't think so. And like, why would they, again, if they see that it clearly works so well with the democratic world, with the pressure, and then lifting sanctions, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we need to look at the global picture, and we need to look at it really carefully when we are talking about peace or ceasefire or ending of the war, because the war didn't start for years in Ukraine. It started 11 years ago when Russia occupied Crimea. And we are where we are right now because at that time, Putin got an appeasement from everyone. And we cannot make the same mistake right now. And I hope that President Trump, who clearly wants to have a Nobel Peace Prize, understands that leaving Ukraine up to Putin and to be turned down is not something that will keep you in history as a peacemaker.
Kira Rudik, thank you for coming back on the show. I appreciate this.
Thank you, Neil, and glory to Ukraine.
Kira Rudik is a member of Ukrainian parliament and the leader of the political party Khalos. She's in Kyiv. For most of us, the basic elements of a city block are so mundane, they're almost invisible. A curb and a few concrete steps here, a stair rail and a park bench there, but skateboarders see them all. They're what they use to make the city their own. And now a small part of San Francisco bears the name of a skateboarder who was able to do just that, even when he wasn't able to see. Zion Williams-Gaines was an avid skater and a leader among his peers. In 2021, he was shot in the face outside a nightclub. He survived, but was left blind in both eyes, so he taught himself to skate again. And he was on the road to fame in the skating world when he died in his sleep before he turned 21. Now the city of San Francisco has renamed one of the skate parks he frequented in his honor. Zion Plaza Skate Park was rededicated in a ceremony just weeks ago. Sean Connolly is the co-founder of the San Francisco Skate Club and a longtime friend of Zion Williams-Gaines. We reached him in San Francisco.
Sean, knowing Zion as you did, how do you think having the skate park that meant so much to him, named for him now, would sit with him?
Well, I feel like he was so connected to the community and he had strong family ties. Maybe he would be really proud of his family members and the community at large for what they were able to accomplish, which was naming a skate park in a city that doesn't like to name skate parks or locations after anybody, from what I understand.
So this is a rare thing. It sounds like he was a rare kind of person, and you knew him for a long time, long before the incident that left him blind in both eyes. What do you remember about when you were first getting to know him?
Well, I remember him being wise beyond his years, for sure. He'd always kind of self-advocate and show up and navigate the city by himself at a young age. And that time on, he was super ambitious about being sponsored and being in the skateboard industry. It was his number one passion for sure.
I know you weren't there when it happened, but from what you have learned and what you understand, what did happen? How did Zion lose his sight?
From my understanding, and what's ironic is it happened about maybe four and a half blocks from where I live, on Haight and Fillmore, is that some sort of argument happened outside of a venue in the evening hours, and it escalated. And I guess the guy that was arguing with Zion and his friend Chris left the area and then came back with a weapon and fired into the crowd indiscriminately. And Zion lost his sight. And Chris, his good friend, was in a position to actually drag him into safety. And it was very sudden. And I don't even know how it could have happened, but the bullets took his sight but didn't affect his brain. Mm-hmm. They didn't make it in deep enough to give him any other issues other than the sight loss, which is amazing to me.
And that criminal case is still going through the courts.
I don't know the ins and outs of the case, but it is still ongoing.
After that shooting, what did Zion tell you the first time you spoke?
So the first time he spoke to me was, I think it was 5 days after the incident. And I had heard rumors about what had happened, obviously, and the word was getting around about what had happened, but I hadn't spoken to him. And I was at my house, and it was in the evening, and I got a call from him, and it sounded like nothing had happened. And he was positive on the phone call. I mean, you know, he was explaining to me, like, all the details, kind of in his own way, from his perspective. But, yeah, it was like nothing had happened, and he was specific about wanting to have the goal of being the best blind skateboarder that there was. So right off the bat, he saw his challenges, understood what he was going through, and he kind of resonated towards his number one passion, which was skateboarding, and didn't want to give it up.
So there was no doubt in his mind. What about you?
I mean, that seems like the hardest thing for me to imagine doing after you lose your sight. So I encouraged him to do the second thing that he wanted to do, was start a skate club-like organization or place for kids in his area, because he lives in Bayview Hunters Point, which is kind of like a marginalized community. They have one skate park, but they don't have any youth programming center around skateboarding. So I encouraged him to start his own program, because That's a really good story right there. It's a good place to start. I wasn't going to stop him from. I don't think anyone could have stopped him from skating.
How did he teach himself to skate again?
He taught himself how to skate again the way he taught himself how to skate the first time. Just started from scratch and worked his way up. He had a natural talent for a couple particular tricks, and of course he went back to those tricks. One of them was the impossible, and the other was the 360 flip, and I think the other one that he consistently had was a nollie heel flip. And from what I understand, he started out trying to use the cane, but I overheard a story from his therapist that he went through 9 canes in about 6 months. And he would put skate stickers on them, and he'd personalize them, and he'd lose them because he really didn't want to have to rely on the cane. But I think as time kind of took over, he realized that he could use the cane for skateboarding, actually, so that he could time the distance from the skate obstacle that he was performing a trick on, which is pretty amazing.
It is really remarkable. And then he died in his sleep, and it was just days before his 21st birthday, so young. And it sounds like there was a lot he wanted to do, so much more.
There definitely was a lot that he wanted to do, and it put a sad ending to all the positivity and all the resilience that he exuded. I really feel like that time that he had in between, that it was a miracle that we all were able to have him and see how he was given these basic parameters, and he still pushed the limits of those parameters. And I feel like we all kind of deal with that in one way or another, maybe with physical limitations or things like that. So his story, for me, is inspiring and will always kind of resonate in the way that you know, we're given what we're given, and we make the most of it when we can. And I feel like he really made the most of the life that he was given.
Sean, I thank you for this. Please take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Sean Connolly is the co-founder of the San Francisco Skate Club. We reached him there. The following is a commercial for the popular fitness app Strava.
I like to run by myself. Fast and far.
I'm free. I like how it feels.
To push myself.
To try things I think I can't do.
To break my own records.
I like to run to accidentally reveal classified details about the locations of world leaders.
I like the way it hurts.
Because it makes me feel
alive.
One of those statements might have sounded a little different from the others. It wasn't the one about how he likes to try things he thinks he can't do, even though that's obviously ridiculous. No one likes that. I barely like trying things I think I can do. No, the truth is that no one has ever actually said that they run to expose state secrets, but they keep doing it anyway. Strava is a fitness app. You go for a run and then you post your route to Strava so your friends can cheer and your enemies can realize you're better than them. It records all kinds of info, including the date and time and the location. And that is a problem if you're a fitness enthusiast who is also a bodyguard responsible for the safety of a world leader. Last October, Le Monde published a bombshell story about bodyguards for Joe Biden, Emmanuel Macron, and others accidentally revealing their boss's locations by posting to Strava. And everyone swore to never do that again. And then this week, the newspaper Dagens Nyheter published a bombshell story about bodyguards for the Prime Minister of Sweden accidentally revealing their boss's location through Strava, including the location of his private residence, which absolutely no one is supposed to know about. And other Swedish bodyguards revealed other sensitive information about other important Swedish people, including the Swedish royal family. Many stories we cover require complicated solutions. This is not one of them. If you're a bodyguard, don't use Strava. Problem solved forever. And if you keep using it, you'll immediately become a running joke. Here's Nico Case with Set Out Running.
Want to get it all behind me. You know, everything reminds me I can be myself without you. Wanna crawl down deep inside the springs inside the mattress where I cry my dirty secrets. Cause I just can't shake this feeling.
And her boyfriends with Set Out Running.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, an advocate for tenant rights tells us she is thrilled Toronto is considering public signs to tell renters whether landlords are meeting basic building maintenance standards, in part because it will make it much harder for bad landlords to hide.
And let's get ready to rumble. We'll hear from an AIH listener who really likes the idea of musical rumble strips, as we heard last night, and would like to see Canada pave the way.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, DJ Ben Frankenstein, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. And coming up at 10 o'clock, it's Headwaters with Malachi Coons, another great mix of music. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. A lot has changed in the past year. The speed limit has not. Speeders can expect to be stopped. Please slow down. Extra speed patrols now on Minnesota roads. You can support KAXE's programming by becoming a sustaining member. Set up your ongoing monthly payment starting at just $5 per month at kaxe.org. Thanks so much to all of the members who make KAXE possible. Weather forecast, tonight increasing clouds, lows 56 to 63, slight chance for showers and thunderstorms. For tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, slight chance of showers, highs 83 to 87.
Pass any restaurant in Toronto, and before you can peruse the menu, you will know whether the venue passed its last food inspection because of the color-coded signage in the window. Green is good, yellow is a conditional pass, and red means it's closed and you probably just lost your appetite anyway. For decades, the mandatory signs have helped provide clarity for diners. And later this month, the city will debate creating a similar program for rental buildings. Chiara Padovani is the co-chair of the York Southwestern Tenant Union. We reached Ms. Padovani in Toronto.
Chiara, if this program does go ahead and those red signs start showing up in buildings right across Toronto, what message do you think those red signs will send?
I think it's going to send a message to tenants that the city is finally listening to them, because tenants have been asking for this kind of program and these kinds of signs now for almost 10 years. And it's going to send a very strong message to landlords who have been neglecting their basic responsibilities that they can't do that in secret anymore. That now it's going to be very public and everyone will know that they're not following the rules or upkeeping their building to current building standards.
There are still details to work out. Program is not a done deal yet, obviously. But from what you know at this stage, what would green, yellow, and red mean in this context?
So green would mean that a building has, you know, reached an acceptable score on the rent safe program, which is how much are landlords following the building standards bylaws that they're required to. And a green sign would mean that they're meeting the minimum requirements. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything is perfect in the building, but it does mean that the landlord is actively taking initiative to meet those standards. That would be a green sign. A yellow sign will mean that there are some ongoing and unaddressed issues. So maybe a pretty rampant pest infestation. Maybe their health and safety or HVAC system isn't quite up to standard, or particularly around mold or ventilation. And then a red sign would be that they're in pretty serious breach of their basic responsibilities. Perhaps something like inconsistent water service or heat interruptions or things like that. That's what I would imagine and what I would like to see those signs represent, and that they would stay up until those violations are addressed. So it really does give incentive to the landlord to address them immediately and as quickly as possible so that they can get their signs switched.
But what's different from obviously the restaurant system of red, yellow, and green is that red doesn't mean, it can't mean that a building is going to shut down entirely.
Correct. Yeah. In this case, it would just be that the landlord needs to take some immediate action. And I would hope that in the case of a red sign, so where there are serious breaches, the landlords would not only be fined, but given a deadline to make those repairs. And if they don't, the city could do something called remedial action, which would go in, make the repairs, make the fixes themselves, and then bill the landlord for it later.
Enforcement is as always crucial, though.
Of course. And we do think that once these signs get going, it is going to help with enforcement, because nobody's going to want a yellow or red sign on their building for very long, because, you know, it impacts their reputation, it impacts their ability to rent to new tenants. But we will need the city to start implementing the program and following up when things need to be changed.
This kind of program has been discussed before. It has not passed, because I know, as you were saying, that there are many people who've been pushing for this kind of thing. But there are also those who are worried that this doesn't just hurt the building management or the building owners. It stigmatizes the people who live inside, who have to walk in and out of those buildings with that blaring red sign out there.
Yeah, we've heard those arguments, and we've only really heard them coming from landlords. And if landlords were really worried about stigmatizing the tenants that live in their buildings, then they would be doing the repairs that they're required to do. Tenants are already stigmatized by having to live in conditions that are substandard. And having a red sign or a yellow sign is actually quite validating. It means that they're being listened to. It means that a city institution has heard them, has validated their concerns, and that now it's up to the landlord to take the action. So that concern about this being stigmatizing to tenants, I'm quite confident that this time around, Toronto City Council will be listening to tenants themselves and not the landlord lobbyists that are using that as an excuse not to do their jobs.
There is a rent safe program in Toronto, and that means rental buildings are inspected. There's a rating posted online. What is missing from the online and the current inspection system that isn't getting the needs of these residents met?
Yeah, I mean, the difference between having to look up a building online and go through, you know, a pretty long evaluation system and seeing a sign on the front door of a building that you're walking into is the same thing about when you're going out for a meal, right? You're not researching or checking, you know, Toronto Public Health's website every time you walk into a restaurant, but you are going to notice a sign on the door. And so that's the first thing, is that it really makes this kind of information far more accessible to tenants, more so than having to find and do your own research and look it up on a website.
There have always been bad landlords out there, difficult tenants too, but on this particular issue, these kinds of buildings that are crumbling and not getting the repairs that they need. But have you seen a shift to doing the work that you do to get us to this point where there needs to be very public shaming to ensure renters have their basic needs met?
Absolutely. And in fact, in our experience, that has been the only way that we have seen landlords actually take significant actions to address these issues in buildings. Unfortunately, the way the residential landlord tenancy law is set up is that landlords really do want tenants to move out, because that's the way that they can increase rents for the next tenant. And there's no real protection from tenants for that. And so as a result, it really just is what's in it for the bottom line. And we think these signs will really go a long way in improving conditions for tenants, but also saving their homes and preventing them from having to move or be evicted.
Chiara, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much.
Chiara Padovani is the co-chair of the York South Weston Tenant Union. We reached her in Toronto. It's been 35 years since this song started getting played on the radio, seemingly on repeat on radio stations across Quebec, and it's never really stopped. Rock Voisin singing the title song from his hit album, Hélène. It sold more than 3 million copies and topped the charts not just in Quebec, but in Europe as well. And if you have tickets to the Festival d'été de Quebec, I'm going to bet Mr. Voisin will pull out that old crowd pleaser when he takes the stage tonight. Rock Voisin talked to the CBC's Julia Caron about the song. Here's part of that interview.
We never knew. It's impossible to know. You know, you just want to make sure it sounds right and it's the arrangements are done well and you sing well and it's played well, and then the rest is history. You can't control, you know, there's so many great songs out there. They don't get the recognition or that they don't get the success, you know, and then you come up with a very simple song like that, and all of a sudden, you know,
it's a phenomenon.
Yep.
Remind us, Huck, where were you at in your career back in 1989 when you were working on this album?
I just moved from Ottawa to Montreal, and I'd been doing like a bit of television, a bit of hosting, you know, sort of learning the strings, you know, and I just signed with Quatre Saisons back then for a teenage type of countdown music kind of show, and we just decided I was gonna record one of my own tunes and play it on my show. That's it. It just, that's where I was, and we just played it for the first time. I basically launched myself.
You are doing a massive tour for the 35th anniversary of Hélène, and you will be on stage at the Place Georges V stage as part of the Festival d'été, and you're going to be performing in front of an audience in Quebec City. What are you looking forward to perform to an audience as part of this 11-day outdoor music festival, as opposed to maybe some of the stadium tours that you've done already?
Oh, I love doing the festival gigs, you know, the outdoor gigs, as long as the weather is nice, you know. You know, there's always that. I mean, it's just the only problem with the festival gigs here in Quebec, you know, during the summer. You have great nights and you have not so great nights because of the weather. But being part of the Festival de Québec is always something quite special. It draws a lot of attention, a lot of people. And we have a good show, and I think people enjoy it. We're expecting a lot of people. It should be jam-packed.
Ruck Voisin talking to Julia Caron, host of Quebec AM. Late this afternoon, the Trump administration dropped its latest tariff proclamation with a rate of 50% for Brazil. That's after the U.S. president upended the plans of Asian countries like Japan, Myanmar, and Vietnam earlier this week, threatening tariffs as high as 25 to 30% on all exports to the U.S. if alternative deals aren't reached by the August deadline. Vietnamese exports that come through a third country would be hit with a levy that would bring those numbers up to a whopping 40 cents on the dollar. For immigrant communities that already face high prices on imported staples like rice and fish sauce, this could really hurt, as grocers who serve them face ever-dwindling profit margins. Hao Tran is the owner of Hao's Grocery and Cafe, a Vietnamese restaurant and specialty supermarket in Fort Worth, Texas. We reached her in Montreal, where she's visiting relatives.
Hao, you're there visiting family, but back in Fort Worth, what kinds of price increases have you been seeing just with the threat of tariffs to come?
We've been seeing a 30 to 40% increase. We shop at, you know, large Asian markets. We see that particularly, I'll focus on fish sauce because it's not produced in the U.S. We rely on, you know, importing. And the cost is from, you know, $6 a bottle to $10 a bottle.
So if these tariffs actually do go up to the levels that the White House is talking about this week, I mean, what would that mean for your bottom line?
It means we'll have to find alternatives. We'll have to find products that are maybe less expensive, but that means sometimes less quality. We have to find alternatives in the U.S. where maybe it could be made here, or we make it ourselves. We can't have the margins that it will affect. As a small boutique grocery, we already have slim margins. And so having to pay so much more, it just eliminates any profitability. And then we also use those ingredients in what we make And so, you know, we'll have to use less or decide that we may not use that product anymore.
What are your customers saying at this point?
Right now, there's not much of a response or effect yet, because, you know, they still feel like that they're comfortable with the price point. But as it escalates, I imagine they probably won't be using the product.
Your family, your parents came to the U.S. from Vietnam in the 70s, and I just know from personal experience, these kinds of shops can certainly be a lifeline for people. What was it like trying to find those ingredients to prepare the dishes your family loved back then?
Well, back then, in the 70s, there weren't any grocery stores, Asian grocery stores. There were, you know, trips that we made from Fort Worth to Dallas into a little store, if you will, but it was more like a closet where they would have stacks of bags of rice, you know, something we needed back then. We couldn't get at grocery stores or American grocery stores. You know, before cell phones, before GPS, my father would try to, you know, make his way through highways and traffic to Dallas. And that, for us, it took, you know, the entire day finding it, trying to make our way back. I mean, we weren't really savvy of traveling by car because we're not familiar with where we were living. So it was a long trip for the whole family to go and source it. And we would have to rely on that bag of rice for a whole month before we make another trip.
Yeah. So how did that go? Your parents had to make it last.
Of course. I mean, we ration ourselves. You know, there's only certain brands that were available. I think there was not even options. There was just one, and a 25-pound bag for a family of five that we could use for a month. And it's something we eat every day. We weren't wasteful. We were taught not to be wasteful. So practically every meal was significant for us.
I was looking at your website for your market and cafe, and you talk about just opening it was such a dream for you. Did that experience you were telling us about, those trips, that rationing of the food that you loved, was that the fuel for this dream?
The fuel for my dream for the store was really to share the type of food and type of flavor that comes with the heritage and culture of where I'm from. And, you know, we actually have rice at the store and we offer different choices. But, you know, there are certain ingredients that I have. I mean, I don't have, like, you know, 15 types of noodles. I have three or four types. Mm-hmm. For the dishes that we make and we offer and we teach people how to use. It's always a pleasure for me when someone comes in, they see a product on the shelf, they see a seasoning, and they have no idea how to use it. They've seen it, but they just don't know how to use it. So it's my privilege to show them, this is what I do, this is how I do it, and these are things that I grew up with, what I learned from my grandmother, what I learned, actually my aunt that lives here that I'm visiting in Montreal taught us, and our conversations were about the food and you know, what are we making, you know, today, and how are we making it, and the community that comes with sharing that with where I live, it's really my pleasure to do that.
And we should say, we talked about Asian customers, but lots of different people shop at all of these stores, whatever your background. And so they add something on another level to whatever neighborhood or town or state they're in.
Absolutely. You know, we're a voice, a much stronger voice, as time has gone by, years have gone by, decades have gone by. And this voice needs to be recognized and to be heard, whether it's in Montreal or it's in Fort Worth. The demand is there, the need is there, and the community is there.
I'm very glad we could speak, Howe. Thank you for this.
You're welcome. I hope I've been helpful.
Howe Chen is the owner of Howe's Grocery and Cafe in Fort Worth, Texas. We reached her in Montreal, where she's visiting family. On last night's show, we told you about an ingenious bit of engineering. On a stretch of highway in Fujairah in the United Arab Emirates, there are rumble strips that sound like Beethoven's Ninth, aka Ode to Joy, when you drive over them. Here's what that sounds like from inside a car. It's sort of music to my ears, and at least one of you agreed.
Hello, guys. It's Ray Bernier and Fisher Branch calling. I just heard your piece about some rumble strips that have been made to sound like Beethoven's Fifth. I actually came up with this idea 25 years ago, going over rumble strips and also going over stretches of gravel where the lines are much closer. You can get a high-pitched squeal. And I was thinking, whoa, two things. That on Trans-Canada Highway especially, we should be putting in these lines so they sing out the first three notes of Oh Canada, you know? Oh Canada. That's all we need. But I also thought, what a commercial opportunity for our highways people to sell jingles that are embedded into the road that way. Of course, it's a simple matter, making tiny grooves at the proper distance so that the notes sound as you're traveling over them, the tire sound. I followed up on it, and it turns out that somebody in Japan already has a patent on the idea, so I didn't follow it up. But I think there's an opportunity there.
Thanks for the call, Ray, and not to make you feel guilty or anything, but to think that if you had followed your instincts 25 years ago, we might have patriotic rumble strips today. If we did, we would be neck and neck with Japan, vis-a-vis rumble strip technology, as you pointed out. Japan has at least 30 of what it calls melody roads. China has one that plays the national anthem, Great Minds, Ray, and also one that plays Ode to Joy. Indonesia has a road that plays the first six notes of Happy Birthday, which I guess you can only drive on once a year. A stretch of Route 66 in the U.S. plays America the Beautiful. And Denmark created the first known musical road, which played an arpeggio in the key of F major. Guess that was the road to Jansville. I haven't found any roads that explore Ray's idea of infusing the streets with capitalism, which is a relief. And if you have any ideas for what you would want to hear from rumble strips on a Canadian road, call TalkBack at 416-205-5687 or email us at aih@cbc.ca.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.